It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, you're listening to the Red Seat Podcast.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Hosted by Jake Devereaux.
It's gone! It's into the bullpen! This game is tied! This game is tied! David Ortiz!
Featuring Keaton DeRocher and Bob Osgood.
Sale winds, he fires.
Swing and a miss, strike play, it's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
Welcome back to the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux. Today I am joined by Bob Osgood of Over the Monster for episode 292 of the show. You can find us on Twitter as well. You can find Bob at BobOsgood15. You can find me at DevJake. And if you want to email us questions, you can do so at RedSeatPodcast@gmail.com. Bob, how you doing tonight?
Good, Jake. Feel rejuvenated, ready to go after, we didn't record last week, but we've had so much that's happened in the meantime. And we've got a really exciting stretch of games coming up. And a lot of things that we talked about, take care of business against some crummy teams, and that turned out to include the New York Yankees, as we thought it might, and they've done that, and now they're playing important games at the end of August and early September, which is really all you can ask for.
Yeah, it's pretty great. We took a little week off to rejuvenate, and boy, were we rejuvenated by what happened with the Red Sox over this little stretch. So let's get right into it, because there's a lot of good news, a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Things are looking up for the Red Sox after a weekend sweep of the last place Yankees. And yes, it does feel great to say last place Yankees. Also, a little bit sweeter that sweep took place in the Bronx. Before we get into the series, I think that low-key one of the worst things the Yankees ever did was knocking down old Yankee Stadium, because that place was just an absolute house of horrors. And this new stadium is just like so cookie cutter, so lame. No one's afraid to go there.
Oh, it's a totally different vibe in there. I mean, just so many years, house of horrors is the perfect way of putting it. And it just kind of like goes along with the end of the Jeter era, I guess, is what I think of. The Jeter and Rivera, and you know, just so many guys from before that just terrorized Boston for so long. And you know, I guess things changed after 2004, but I just think of growing up and them coming back in the bottom of the ninth and the place just shaking. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's just that the team isn't that great. I totally get what you're saying, that in, you know, I think that they kind of at the beginning priced out some people. Some of the closer seats were empty early on. You know, I don't know how much they've adjusted that, but it's just, it never feels like it's totally full and that they're right on top of everybody like the old days. And you know, you say the last place Yankees, it was kind of going back and forth for a while. I mean, they're 60-64 now and six games clear of any other team for last place. And man, that was an abomination that we saw over the weekend.
Yeah, it was, and it's sweet to see that. Going into the weekend on Friday, I wrote an article just about how much I enjoy still watching the Yankees suffer And, you know, no matter what's going on with the Red Sox, just how bad we are, you know, when we are bad, and not to say that we're terrible right now, we're actually doing all right. We're, you know, that's a lot of what today's show is going to be. But even when things are going bad with the Red Sox, it's just so sweet to see the Yankees be horrible. And also, you know, they used to call the Yankee Stadium the house that Ruth built. And now, like, what are they going to call this new place? Like, the house that Judge hit 62 home runs in because right field's ridiculous? Or, like, I don't even know. It's just...
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, it was a very well-timed piece that you came out with on Friday. I'm sure it was intentionally coinciding with the series that was in the Bronx, but to see them come out and play like that, I mean, there were points that they made the Red Sox look like a good defensive team and a good base running team, you know, on Friday night, just kicking the ball all over the park, and a lot of that continued on Saturday as well. You know, Sunday was a better game, but you know, even the announcers, you know, I had to, you know, go back and watch some of the highlights just from different parts that I didn't catch in real time. And, you know, some of the Yankee calls that are on there, they hit a game tying home run and Michael Kay is screaming, "The sky is blue and the game is tied at two." What is this? And then John Sterling is yelling, it's Glaber Day. Just, you know, that clown stuff that's going on when you have a last place team, it really just doesn't fit that well. It doesn't have the same oomph as it did maybe 10 years ago, unless John Sterling's getting hit with a foul ball in the box or something.
What did he say when that happened again?
Oh! He was three or four of those. It hit me, Susan.
Oh, that's amazing. All right, so let's get to the actual baseball. So, you know, obviously they won all three games here. The first game was really the Bayo show. You want to talk about what you took away from the first game of the series?
Yeah, I think that it was really important to get Brian Bayo back in check on Friday night, and he's pitched so well for a year plus now in Yankee Stadium. There were multiple games down the stretch last year, a couple of Sunday night games that he pitched great against New York, and that continued. And it's hard to know whether it's that Bayo is, you know, coming into a hot streak or if it was a bad team that made him look good, but... You know, I think that we've kind of seen Bayo made some advancements this year, but he definitely has a lot to work on in the offseason, and finding an out pitch to throw against right-handers is something that he's going to have to do. You know, he's got fastball and the changeup, and the slider can be a very good pitch, but I think it's been about a 350 average against this year. And it was better the other night. And again, you know, is that the hitting that was going against him? But, you know, he threw 13 sliders and he had 38% for the CSW, called strikes or whiffs against it. And I thought that he was, you know, throwing it pretty confidently and was getting outs on the pitch. You know, his changeup looked good. His velocity has been there. You know, he was throwing 97 with the sinker and the four seam, 97.2. So that's continued to be there, and they've been able to ride him for a lot of innings last season, more than I expected them to. You know, they pitched him all the way to the end of the season, and he's thrown a lot of innings this year after kind of a, you know, a slow start. It took him a couple weeks to get ramped up after the initial injury, but I just thought that was really big, especially with his next two starts are going to be against Houston. He's going to face them on Thursday, and then he would be lined up to face them again next week at home. He needed some positive momentum. And, you know, like I said, it'll take a long time for him to be, if he can get to that frontline starter, if he can continue to make adjustments. But this was a good step in the right direction after a couple of duds before that.
Yeah, it makes some sense, too, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later. But, you know, the fact that we have Houck coming back today as you're listening to this, you know, the fact that they're thinking about going to that six-man rotation for a little bit, it makes sense because Bayo is about at 120 innings right now. And as you mentioned, I mean, going against Houston twice in the next 10 days is going to be a real big test for him. So, you know, we'll see how he does there. I'm pretty confident in the guy right now with how he's going. Aside from Bayo having a great game in that first win, I think of it as sort of the day that Yoshida got back on track. He had that big home run in the first off Brito, and that was a 3-run shot to make it 4-0. That was important because Yoshida has frankly looked a little bit run down as of late, and I think that Cora did a really good job responding to that with sitting him a couple times against the Nationals and then getting him back in the lineup the last game. And we saw the dividends, you know, come right in on Friday with that big home run. And hopefully he can kind of get back on track because, you know, he's hitting in a key spot for this team. He's hitting third and doing so again tonight. So already had a hit off of a knuckle curve in this game. But, you know, I'm looking for him to keep that momentum because obviously, you know, the Japanese season being a lot less taxing because it's shorter and because the travel's all in one time zone. It's not very far. A lot of the travel's on train. This is a huge adjustment for him.
Yeah, that absolutely. And they've been giving him more days off, and Cora has mentioned that he's gonna there's more travel than he's used to, that it's a longer season, that it's a grind, you know. He's been giving him more days off, gives him a couple in a row sometimes. You know, it didn't totally carry over throughout the weekend, but that was such a huge hit to kind of set the tone early in the series. And, you know, I mean, he's still in that top two in the Rookie of the Year race, and he's still hitting up near 300. And, you know, could if one hot streak can have a chance to be back in that batting title race. And it's definitely overall going to be a good first season, but you know, if they can find a way to get back in the playoff race, there's going to be big games down the stretch that he's going to need to be in the lineup for, potentially playoff games if they can get there. They're going to need him. So, yeah, that was a huge hit the other night.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another guy who's had huge hits was Julio Urias, the pickup at the trade deadline. I mean, talk about a week that this guy had. Grand slam against the Nationals and then coming in having a grand slam in the second inning off of Gerrit Cole in that game too. And when you looked at it on paper heading into this series, if there was a game that the Yankees should have won, it was obviously game two with Gerrit Cole on the mound versus Cutter Crawford. But, you know, Crawford flipped the script, had 6 innings, only allowed 1 earned run, struck out 5. Gerrit Cole continued to have the Red Sox in his head. 4 innings, 6 earned runs. You know, Wong homered off of him, too. I mean, it was just like, it was kind of embarrassing for Gerrit Cole, a guy who's probably going to win the Cy Young. He just can't figure this Red Sox team out, and I'm totally here for it. I love the fact that, like, this is the Pedro Martinez situation with the Yankees completely reversed.
Yeah, except I feel like Cole gets lit up in the regular season more than Pedro ever did.
Oh, totally. Man, he's not in that class. I mean, right. Like, yeah, let's be honest. They're not comparing those two.
No. It's great how locked in Rafael Devers continues to be and how well he sees the ball from Cole because, you know, he gets a line drive hit right away in the first inning. And then a second time up, he gets another hit. And sure, he didn't have the home runs, but he was on base twice early. I think that was the game that he was a triple short of the cycle, where he homered later off of a reliever. And it's just, it's a no-brainer. I mean, if you're putting in some sort of prop bet when Rafael Devers is in Yankee Stadium and specifically up against Gerrit Cole, it's usually going to win. And it's been time and time again. And Devers having 3 hits in, I think, every game in the series. You know, he just sets a tone. And then, yeah, it was Urias and it was Wong. And, I mean, Urias hitting grand slams and consecutive plate appearances, you know, over 2 games, consecutive pitches, I believe. You know, he's only had 36 plate appearances, but he's made them count so far.
Yeah, I saw a couple funny things about, you know, people who started Urias in their fantasy leagues for that week, you know, just like 4 plate appearances or something like that in 8 right. RBIs, 2 home runs. So pretty efficient.
Where did that come from?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the last game of the series, it was definitely the best game of the three. The other ones weren't particularly close, but this one, it was a 2-2 game. You know, all the way into the bottom of the sixth, or the top of the seventh, really, I should say. And Turner hit the big three-run shot to go ahead 5-2 and then go ahead in the bottom of the seventh. And John Schreiber gives one up to Volpe, tie the game up at 5. I know you want to talk about Turner and what he did in that game in particular. Again, you know, winning the game, but I'll turn it over to you.
I think just generally an appreciation for what Justin Turner is doing this year with a foot injury that I think if it was in a different time of the season, he might have taken 4 to 6 weeks off, as they said that it would need for it to heal. And he instead is kind of playing 2 or 3 games on and then taking a day off, which he's taking a day off on Monday because he's really noticeably having trouble running and he's not playing the field right now. But he's making every at-bat count. And, you know, just the guts that he's showing out there and the hits that he's getting in these key spots. As you said, the 3-run homer and then the go-ahead hit yesterday. You know, in it, whether you're a believer in clutch and late and all of that, you know, I am. But with 2 outs and runners in scoring position, he's hitting .342 this year with a .1088 OPS. And then in late and close situations where it's if you're up in the seventh inning or later with the game tied or ahead by one run or the tying run is at least on deck is how they define that. He's had 63 of those plate appearances this year, and he's hitting .340 with 4 homers and 17 RBIs and a .1070 OPS. So he has come up in the biggest spots, and it's been a countless number of hits that he's had to tie games, to go ahead, and he did it again on Sunday. Just in a huge game, you know, I mean, they really just to keep pace with everybody, they had to have the sweep. And you're looking at a 38-year-old who is going to have an opportunity to have career highs in numerous categories this year. You know, his career high in runs is 87. He has 72 of them this year. His career high in RBIs is 90, and he has 79 already. So he's going to blow that away. His career high in homers is 27, and he's got 20 with 38 games to play. So he is beyond the pace of all of those categories, you know, somebody at that age, 38 years old, who did, he was a late breakout. His first big year was when he was 30. So this is kind of his 10th year as the Justin Turner that we know that was with the Dodgers for all of those years. But just such an enormous leader in the clubhouse and showing that on the field, both being out there as well as getting big hits. I mean, just arguably the MVP of the team so far with just how much he's given them, like I said, in the clubhouse and on the field.
Yeah, I can't agree more. He's just been phenomenal. I was super excited about him because I always loved watching him when he was with LA. And he's really even gone well beyond my expectations for him this year. I didn't expect him to turn back the clock to this degree and to continue to be this good of a hitter, but you know, going back, looking at that comparison between Justin Turner and JD Martinez, because I think we've been making that a few times. You know, Turner has 20 home runs, JD Martinez 25 home runs. But when you look at the slash line, I think that's really the big difference. Turner's got 288, 356, 488 slash, whereas JD Martinez is 256, 309. 547. So he's slugging a little bit more, but I mean, certainly Turner is striking out about half as often as JD Martinez is. JD Martinez has a 31.3% strikeout rate, whereas wow, Turner's at 16.6. So I think that's just the big difference. Is Turner is certainly a much better clubhouse guy for this particular clubhouse, you know, with the fit here. The fact that he has the defensive versatility that he does, I know that the heel has been hindering him a little bit and making him only basically a DH recently. But, you know, the fact that he has been able to play some first and even sub in at third every once in a while, I think there's no question in my mind that this was the right call by the Red Sox. And this is my favorite offseason move by Chaim Bloom for sure.
It kind of got to a point where it was the obvious fit. I mean, even, you know, you mentioned the defensive versatility for him to slide in and play second a few times when yeah, they were kind of at their, you know, the most need that they had at that time, because that was the only thing that fit, was that someone had to move a position for them to get everybody in the lineup. You know, just another example that he was willing to do that, a position he hadn't played in, I think more than 5 years at that point. So just countless examples of where he has been just such a key player and kind of been a glue for them this year.
Yeah, he's got 34 games at first base, 10 at second base, and 7 at third base.
Yeah.
So that's about as versatile a 38-year-old as you can possibly ask for.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'd love to see him back for another year.
Absolutely. Before we wrap up talking about the Yankees series, I know that you were pretty fired up about Alex Cora getting fired up. And Alex Cora obviously didn't really like the strike zone on Sunday, made that well known. He's also been tweaking our pal Chaim Bloom a little bit by wearing an Underdog t-shirt pretty much every time out now. So
how have I not noticed that?
I don't know. I don't know. He's had one on like the last 3 days in a row.
Oh, wow.
A different Underdog shirt from the cartoon. So, I mean, how important do you think Cora has been to the recent success here? It seems like he's really dialed into how these guys are feeling in the clubhouse.
Oh, I love it. I love just angry, fired up Alex Cora. And you just can kind of you can tell when it's happening. You know, usually he probably just got tossed out of a game in recent days. You see some quotes through the media, and he had that on Sunday. I don't care if I get fined. He's dropping multiple F-bombs talking about the umpire's strike zone in the post game.
Rightfully so. It was a garbage zone.
Oh, it was awful. But, you know, he has good ejections. You know, he goes out there and he makes the most of those, you know, 30 seconds to a minute that he's out there and doesn't put on a clown show like someone in the other dugout. So I think that he's definitely, as you said, kind of being a mouthpiece for the team there, which he should be. But he's got their back. And I wondered, it wasn't a matter of if, but a matter of when he was going to get ejected on Sunday, because it was bad early. And then it got to the point where, you know, his fourth player was calmly talking to the umpire and handling it the right way. So at that point, he's got to go out there and take one for the team. And he did it, in my mind, at the perfect time. And then to continue that into the post game. And just generally, I think that he's in that playoff Cora mode and has been for 2 weeks since. You know, he's been going to the bullpen in the fifth inning, you know, Sale for obvious reasons with the pitch count, but he's been doing it with Crawford. He doesn't care who's getting the win. He doesn't care if those guys care if they're going to get the win. He's going to get you in the fifth inning when the lefty's up, and he's going to make a move because that's the time to do it. And if he doesn't do that now, then the September games aren't going to matter. So it's just, yeah, I don't know. I can tell when he's got, you know, a little extra, and it definitely started this weekend.
Yeah, it is. It's special to see him like this, and hopefully he keeps up the energy all the way through this stretch. I think he's got plenty of reasons to stay energized with how the club's playing recently.
Yeah.
But let's get to that a little bit. So since we last spoke 2 weeks ago on the podcast, you know, we had talked about the fact that they were going to have to play the Royals, the Tigers, the Nationals, the Yankees, all teams that we felt were very, very beatable for this Red Sox club. They took three out of four, I should say, from the Royals, two out of three from the Tigers, dropped two out of three from the Nats, who are very, very hot right now. You know, I think about Stone Garrett hitting that home run, and like, you know, they caught the Nats at a tough time in D.C. But then they go ahead and swept the Yankees, and they went 9-4. Over that stretch, which I think just speaks kind of volumes about this team in general. After that disastrous series with the Blue Jays, where I proclaimed that they were dead in the water, man, and that's truly how I felt, to see them go 9-4 right after that and win these games that they've had such trouble winning this year against teams that, you know, aren't successful. They've done a lot better against playoff teams than they have against non-playoff teams. See them handle business like that, I thought that was phenomenal. But I know that one of the things that bugged you about it was the fact that, like, they barely gained any ground over that stretch.
Yeah, and that goes back to the Toronto series, right? Which we're not going to revisit. We're going to have a little more positivity on this episode than we might have recently. But that was our point, is just how important that Toronto series was, and you get swept out of that, and that is a three-game swing in either direction. You can be three games ahead, or you can be three games behind when you come out of that, and they put themselves in that situation, and you don't control your own destiny. You don't have the games in hand that you need, but what's done is done, right? You have to go out, and you're playing four sub-500 teams, and... it went 9-4, right? So they didn't win all four series, but the sweep of the Yankees kind of made up for the two losses against Washington that you mentioned. And that's what they had to do. They had to go 9-4 in those 13 games. That's probably the number we would have put on it that could have gotten them close to even. But nobody went 500 in that time. In fact, Seattle ramped it up, and Toronto continued to win at a similar pace. I think they might have gained a game on Toronto, but it didn't matter because... Seattle is just a wagon, and they have the hottest player in the league right now in Julio Rodriguez, and they trade their closer in the National League because they may or may not be contending, and didn't matter. They've been better since. They played some wild games with Kansas City the whole week, and they just kind of kept coming out on top of those, even when their relievers were blowing those games, just because their bats are just crazy hot. And then tonight, right before we came on, we saw that they had 5 runs in the first inning against your buddy Touki Toussaint there. So, yeah, I mean, Seattle's the problem. And what this causes is them needing the team that they can gain ground on in the wild card race is Houston. That's where they have the most games in hand to pass a team that currently has a wild card spot. And that is not an easy task. And we know that Houston added a lot more than Boston did. And, you got to go out and do something like go 5-2 against the Astros to actually get back to where you need to be. And I wouldn't bet on that.
Well, Seattle would love to see that. That's for sure.
Yep.
As we alluded to, they're 3 games back of the final wild card spot. Those spots are held by Tampa Bay, Houston, and Seattle, but, you know, as you just mentioned, with how hot Seattle's been, Seattle's really making a charge for that division. So, we've got the games against Houston, the two series against them, 4 games set in Houston, and then 3 games at Fenway. And then we also play LA at home in the middle of that. But the Red Sox are getting healthy at the right time, I think. That's one of the things that's going to help Cora during this stretch, really maximizing his guys, is the fact that, you know, as you're listening to this podcast on Tuesday, they're getting Tanner Houck back. He's getting added to the rotation. They're getting fully healthy at the right time. And now this gives them sort of an interesting group of guys between, you know, Houck, Pivetta, Crawford, a lot of guys that they can kind of mix and match in games and get some extra innings out of. How do you see this whole thing shaking out with how Cora deploys these arms over the next 10 days of super important games?
It's really tough, to the point that I wouldn't be outraged by either pitcher between Pivetta and Crawford going to the bullpen. Nick Pivetta this year has thrown 56 innings as a starter and 50 as a reliever. He's a 5.88 ERA as a starter, and he has a 2.52 ERA as a reliever. And then, you know, Cutter Crawford, 6-5 with a 4.24 as a starter, 0-1 with a 1.66 and 22 innings as a reliever. It's kind of crazy how both of their splits are. If it was me, I probably would keep Pivetta in the bullpen. I think just generally, you know, Crawford has been starting games for a while now. I think that it's a role that he's looked a lot better lately, getting to 5-6 innings. He looked, you know, great in New York, obviously. So I think I would lean that way a little bit. But if they go with Pivetta, just because he's been pretty hot for 3 months now in various roles, or they want to do the opener with Pivetta just because it works when he comes out in the second inning a little bit better, I think that's fine too. And it looks like, you know, the way they're going to slot Houck in is to have the 6 starters pitch over 6 days, which I think is the right move in 17 straight days or whatever they're playing right now. Potentially it works itself out, but I think if it comes to the point where they start mixing in off days and need to send somebody, I would lean towards Pivetta.
Yeah, I would too. I love the way that Pivetta has looked out of the pen, and also I think that Crawford's probably a starter for you next year as well, so you probably want to keep him getting comfortable in that role, but ultimately I think that all Hauk, Pivetta, and Crawford are going to get a hell of a lot of run over this 10-day stretch here. With Hauk, I mean, he's going to get thrown right back into the fire. Talk about like a soft welcoming back. I mean, here you go, buddy. You got Houston twice as you're coming back out. So, you know,
I just can't state enough that just the kind of mentally what the hurdles that are there after what happened to him.
Oh, you know, we can't
forget about it. He doesn't have an off season to, I guess it's, you know, good just get back out there. And by all accounts, everything was kind of back when he was at Worcester. But just stepping on the mound and being out there after that happening, it's just such a gruesome injury and such a tough sport to watch when you see a comebacker like that. You know, you can't take that for granted that he's back out there this year. And I'm looking forward to seeing him pitch and what his level of confidence is on Tuesday night.
Yeah, me too. And I'm happy to see him back out there so soon. You know, I think he could have taken a little bit more time if he needed it. But, you know, he knows how important these games are and how much his arm is needed.
Yep.
Let's talk about that roster spot, though. So when he comes back, I think it's really between two guys, whether or not they'll DFA Mauricio Jovera, who I can't stand, or option Chris Murphy. Do you have strong feelings one way or the other like I do?
Yeah, I don't want to see Jovera anymore. I don't care that he pitched well on Saturday in New York, because we've been over that. I can throw that outing out by all I care. You know, it was a 6-7 run game at the time. Haven't liked what I've seen, and I think that this is just, forget about the options, forget about the 40-man. This is, you need to have your best 13 out there from here on out every single game. So thanks for the two shutout innings and a blowout on Saturday, but I'm all set with you, Vera.
Yeah, those were pretty non-competitive at-bats from the Yankees, too. I actually caught all of the Jovera, which is, you know, just my luck.
That's great.
When I tune in that I would get to watch all the Jovera, but I was just, I was not impressed by how the Yankees were approaching those at-bats.
I agree. I don't see another move on there. I think the bullpen's pretty set right now.
Yeah, I agree. For this series, Duran might be a little bit banged up. He suffered a toe contusion. We know that he wasn't in the lineup tonight as we're recording this on a Monday. Duvall get the start in center rather than him, so Duvall should get some extra time. But I also noticed something is that even since Trevor Story has come back, Pablo Reyes, who's continued to be hot, is getting play every single day, whether it's at shortstop or second base. And I want to just point that out, because I think that that's kind of an important thing with, you know, the year that Pablo Reyes has had. We've talked about it a number of times, just how crazy it is that this guy was on a AAA team for the worst team in baseball and, you know, has carved out an everyday role with the Red Sox, who are, you know, trying to contend for a wild card spot at this point. I just think it's one of the most amazing stories. And even a guy who Cora had said he didn't even see him as a starting caliber player in this league, and now he can't keep him out of the lineup.
I know. I mean, it's just, how long does this last for, right? I mean, he's played 45 games now, and he's hitting .331. So it's hard to question. His strikeout rate is 11%, which is phenomenal.
It's awesome.
And he's playing good defense, and he's an excellent base runner, and he's a great bunter. All things like, you know, just small ball things that Cora would appreciate and has forced him to play every day. As you said, they got the guys back that they've been waiting for. And he outlasted Yu Chang. And then, you know, he made I think there was a pass ball that he had the right instinct play and scored the game-winning run there. Big home runs, obviously the walk-off grand slam that might have cemented his spot on the team anyways. But yeah, I mean, he's splitting time at shortstop and second. When Story isn't in there, he's playing short. It's fascinating, and you know, you mentioned a couple weeks ago that this is the best story of the season that just came out of nowhere. I mean, for a 30-year-old, you know, this is a 30-year-old minor league cast-off from Oakland, and it's just, it's great to watch just the energy that he brings to the game. And yeah, I mean, like I said, 45 games with a 331 average. So that's not a small sample size anymore.
No, it's not. And he's been just about as important a guy as anybody on this team during this season. So absolutely love Pablo Reyes. Fantastic story. Let's get to previewing this Houston series, though, because it's an important one. Obviously, game one is already going on. Paxton versus Javier is going on as we record this right now. It's 4-3 Houston in the bottom of the third right now. Paxton not doing so hot. Javier giving up the big bomb to Duval as well. But this is an interesting series. We've got Houck going against Verlander as you're listening to this today. Then Sale versus Urquidy. Bayo versus France. A couple notes about Houston as they, you know, as they get into this series. Altuve, Bregman, Turner, and Alvarez might be the best 1-4 in the game. For the defending World Series champs. They avoid Framber Valdez, which is awesome because he's great. And Houston has a really strong bullpen. And a couple guys that I noticed as well, Diaz and Chaz McCormick, having nice years for them, sort of out of nowhere. So, you know, looking at this series, how do you feel about it overall?
Yeah, and you don't want to look too much at the pitching matchups because that doesn't tell the whole story, and the bullpens are a big part of it. But as you said, they don't see Valdez, who, outside of the no-hitter, which is, you know, a big, you know, asterisk, right? Of course that happened, but outside of that, he's kind of gotten lit up a few times. But you still don't want to see him because you know he can pull that 7-8-inning game out of nowhere. But you're seeing Urquidy, who has been injured and really hasn't given them a whole lot recently. And then J.P. France, who is kind of pitching over his head a little bit. His ERA is 2.75, but he has a 4.15 FIP, and I think kind of generally that this isn't the pitcher that he is. So I think he can get to both of those guys. But yeah, I mean, it's just Altuve, as you said, Altuve, Bregman, Tucker, and having Yordan Alvarez back. You know, it's they've got the edge there. They have a good bullpen, and then the catcher Diaz and McCormick. They both are hitting for power, and this team can come out of nowhere and just hit you with 10 runs and put it into the Crawford boxes and all of that. So, you know, I do like the outside of the Verlander matchup, seeing him on Tuesday, who has been, you know, strong striking guys out again in the second half. You know, I think you've got some decent matchups pitching wise. But that doesn't, you know, there's just so much more to the game, and with a lot of these guys going five innings and all that these days.
Yeah, I agree. I want to focus on that lineup, though, a little bit, because I think that's the thing that really carries things for the Astros, is the lineup has just been incredible. Jose Altuve, low-key having one of the better years of his career, hitting 327, 420, 529. I think there's a very legitimate case that can be made for Jose Altuve being a Hall of Famer at some point. I don't know how the stuff will play with him and the, you know, Astros cheating scandal and sort of how central he was to that. But the fact that he has just continued to do this is pretty amazing. And then Bregman, Tucker, and Alvarez have been phenomenal. Kyle Tucker's a guy I slept on a lot. I mean, I just didn't think that he was ever going to be this caliber of a player coming into this series. He's got 24 home runs, 24 stolen bases, basically hitting 300, slugging over 500. He's been incredible. But, you know, what are your thoughts on Altuve as a potential Hall of Fame guy? By Fangraphs, he's already got 51.7 F-WAR, and he's still going strong.
I know. I feel like I just have no idea with what we've seen over the last few years, over the last 20 years, with, we're not going to get in a whole Hall of Fame debate, right? But it's just so hard to know what people value, what stories that came out are controversial for one guy, but not for another. I mean, they put David Ortiz right in there, right? And he was on some lists and that was ignored. But then there's some other players that we're still looking at saying, well, this is one of the best five hitters or pitchers in the history of the game, and Bonds and Clemens, right? So who knows what's going to happen with Houston. just any of those guys, how that's going to be held with managers and players and all of that. But if you just look at statistics, he has an MVP season. He's got a .308 average. He's over 2,000 hits. You know, he's not going to get to 3,000, but he's going to be past 2,500 hits, probably well past that when he retires. You know, and just crazy stolen base numbers. He's back. I mean, he's got 13 steals in 54 games this year. So, I mean, if you prorate that, he'd be an over 30 steal guy. Again, he missed a lot of the year with the wrist injury. But he's going to, if he has three or four more seasons, and it seemed like he was falling off briefly, and then the last 3 years he's been awesome again. So if he has three more of these years, you'd have to say on paper without the other nonsense that he can get himself there.
I think the biggest shock for me was like seeing him at the start of his career, you know, 2011 through 2014, how he had those single-digit home run totals. Right. And a lot of stolen bases. Like, that's the type of player that I kind of expected him to be throughout his career. And obviously, like, even if he was 2014 Jose Altuve with the 7 home runs and 56 steals and hitting well over 300, that's a great player. That's an all-star. But the fact that he has blossomed into hitting 20-plus home runs, even 30-plus home runs on a couple occasions, is just something I never thought was going to be possible for a guy his size. So
yeah,
that kind of
seeing 31 on that sheet twice is just shocking.
Yeah, I mean,
even I forgot that
he's probably 5'5", to be honest, because I've seen him in person and I've been very close to him on the field, and like, he is not a big dude. He's listed at 5'6". I don't think he's even 5'6". He's small.
Yeah,
so it's really incredible. I wanted to ask you though about Kyle Tucker and what's his name, the Alvarez, the big dude. Which one of these guys do you think is the better hitter? Because Tucker is probably a little bit more consistent, but I feel like game on the line up there, I'm more afraid of Alvarez. How do you feel about those two guys?
Yeah, I feel similarly. I think that it said a lot in the years when they had a deeper lineup, when Tucker would hit sixth or seventh in that lineup, and he and Alvarez are the same age, they're both 26. But yeah, I mean, the batting average getting up to 296 this year, and he's a 275 hitter including that, so probably closer to 265, 270 entering the season in his career. So he's taken that leap that you and I both kind of weren't sure if he had. He was always that he's a great fantasy baseball player, and we know him from that with the fact that he mixes in the power and the speed. But would he be a real life just kind of elite player? And he's getting closer to that. I mean, 92 RBIs with 40 games to go is a pretty crazy number that he's at. You know, now that he's hitting closer to the top of the lineup, I think that helps. But I'm the same way. I mean, Alvarez terrifies me. We saw what he did in the playoffs last year. I mean, to the point that, like, when he was up, you kind of knew that he was going to homer on that one. I think it was against, was it Seattle, where he hit the 3-run walk-off homer. And then in the playoffs the year before, he was hitting lefties as a left-handed hitter as well as anybody. They kept bringing in lefties, or they would leave Sale in to pitch against him, and he would just pepper the green monster for the whole series. So just the power that he has and the way that he hits you know, righties and lefties equally. But, you know, it's a matter of staying on the field for him. He has not quite been able to do that. 144 games in 2021, 135 last year, and only 79 with an injury this year. So, you know, it's more kind of, will he be able to stay on the field with the big body?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think that's good analysis. I want to just talk about Kyle Tucker here for a second, though, because I was a pretty big Kyle Tucker doubter when he was coming up. And one of the big reasons why is because, you know, he carried some not high strikeout rates, but like strikeout rates that you expected to be a problem to some degree at the big league level when he was in the minor leagues in 2019. Had that 30-30 season in AAA, he was striking out 21.6% of the time. And you always figure that when a guy gets to the major leagues, like, that's going to go up a little bit. And it did. When he finally did get to the majors that year, he had a 27.8% strikeout rate. And you're thinking, like, okay, you know, this guy's probably going to carry somewhere around like 24, 25% strikeout rate in the big leagues. All he's done since he's been in the big leagues is cut that. He went down to 20.2%, then 15.9%, and this year he's all the way down at 13% strikeout rate while still hitting for power. That's just amazing. I've never really seen a guy make that type of transformation with, you know, not striking out to that degree. And I will never forget, I was watching the draft where he was picked the year, 2015, when he was picked fifth and went to the Astros. And somebody in that draft compared Kyle Tucker's swing to Ted Williams. And I was just like, what are we doing here? Like, what on earth are we doing to this kid, comparing him to Ted freaking Williams? And now all of a sudden, this dude's like hitting 300 with almost nearly identical walk to strikeout rate at the big league level, putting up basically MVP level numbers. It's insane. I just
never thought this
was happening.
You're mentioning the walks now, because it was 5.6 to 7.9 to 9.3, and now it's 11.5. And yeah, it's almost equal.
Yeah.
Which is nuts. You should look at Acuna's page, because that's the only other one that I can think of this year with someone hitting for that kind of power. You know, Acuna had a 23.6 K rate last year, and it's down to 12.3 K percentage this year, which is like, where does that come from? How are you cutting your strikeouts in half and doubling your home run rate? But Tucker has done it kind of progressively, you know, getting in that direction. Now it's almost even. Yeah, I mean, he's an outstanding hitter. It's hard to kind of poke any holes. Doesn't have the, well, he's not Ted Williams, I'll tell you that much, but, you know, he's putting his third outstanding power speed season together in a row, and has the average there now too, you know, 145 WRC plus. I had not heard that comparison, but you can't be doing that to anybody. Just like when they compared, they said Jason Dominguez was the next, it's escaping me now. It was someone outrageous.
I don't know. Barry Bonds, something crazy.
Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I just, you don't hear people compared to Teddy Ballgame very often, so that one freaked me out a little bit. And
scouting report said that Dominguez is a mix of Bo Jackson, Mickey Mantle, and Mike Trout. That was God,
that's so MLB.com's
scouting report when he was 16 years old. Mickey Mantle was the name I was thinking of. That's what the most, yeah.
Yeah, one of the top 3 to 5 center fielders in baseball history. Yeah, no worries
Let's put all three of them on there for you.
Yeah. Well, all right. So with this Houston series, obviously we got game one going on. How many do you think they take in Houston?
I'll say 2 out of 4. What do you think?
I'm going to go 3 out of 4.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm going to be aggressive here. I like the pitching matchups that they have. I think game two is going to be a tough one, but I really like the matchups later on. Sale versus Urquidy, Bayo versus France. And I think they'll eke out a win tonight. So we shall see. All right, then they come back home versus LA, and this is going to be a really fun series. We've got Carter Crawford versus Julio Urias, Paxton again on the mound versus Emmett Sheehan, a nice rookie for them. I know that you're a big Sheehan guy as well. And then we've got Houck versus Bobby Miller. The thing that I noticed when looking at the Dodgers lineup is, you know, the bullpen's a little bit weaker than it has been in the past for them. Tony Gonsolin's hurt. He's shut down for the year. Red Sox are avoiding Clayton Kershaw, which is always a good thing because anytime he's on the mound, he's still elite. Betts and Freeman, we talked about how deep that 1 through 4 was for Houston. I think that Betts and Freeman might be the best 1-2 punch in the entire league. So what are your thoughts about this particular series?
I'd say that I'm looking forward to this series more than anything all year. I mean, this is the benefit of playing every team every season. You know, it doesn't hit you in small spurts, but then you realize that you get to see every team, and every other year LA will be coming in to Fenway, and what a cool matchup this will be. And just so much crossover of ex-Dodgers that are on the Red Sox and ex-Red Sox that are now on the Dodgers, and Kike Hernandez, who was on the Dodgers, then the Red Sox, and now the Dodgers again, and playing every day, and of course hitting 282, making game-ending spectacular plays since he's gone back there. But we've talked about Kike enough this year. But I think that there's just, you know, between JD Martinez and Justin Turner and Kenley Jansen, there's so many interesting storylines here. The Dodgers have lost two games the entire month. They're just on an absolute heater. As you said, Betts and Freeman, especially Betts lately, is just on a crazy pace once again. I mean, we're going to look up and what his numbers at the end of the year are going to be. And, you know, it's going to be, you know, one of the, not great seasons all time, but great seasons that we've seen in the last 10 years. If he continues to compile numbers that he has been while playing second base and shortstop when they need him, you know. So
it's insane how much like they've been unafraid to use him in all these different spots.
Yes, just put him right out there, not in emergencies, not after a pinch hitter, to start the game, and he's turning double plays like it's no problem. So yeah, I mean, it's great, you know, that they're not going to see Kershaw. I'm fine with that, especially with the state of their rotation. They've had a lot of injuries. They really don't have a closer. You know, Evan Phillips and Brusdar Graterol are kind of splitting that. So they don't have, you know, I think that they're going to go all in next year because they've reset the luxury tax. And yet, while that's going on, and with Gonsolin hurt and a banged up rotation, they've lost two games the whole month. So it's going to be a really interesting series. Lance Lynn is over there now, too, with a 1.44 ERA since he's been traded to the Dodgers, after having the worst ERA in all of baseball for the White Sox. So I would say that he was kind of mailing it in with the paycheck over in Chicago. But no, it's going to be great. I can't wait to see that, and I'm glad that it's at Fenway.
I have to say, the Dodgers, they are the team that I like wish the Red Sox were. The way that they run that operation over there is just... it's incredible. They're a pitching factory. Their player development is insane. It's always on point. They're just always producing good quality big league talent, especially on the pitching side. Like, you know, we talked about Bobby Miller, who was a high draft pick, and then Emmett Sheehan, who was a little bit less highly touted. But, you know, both of those guys are going to be going against the Red Sox. And then, you know, paying the guys that they paid, paying that contract to Freddie Freeman was amazing. It's already delivered so much for them. I mean, just looking at his numbers this year, Freddie Freeman, 23 home runs, 102 runs scored, .333 batting average, .411 OBP, .575 slug. He's having the second best season of his career, and he's doing it at age 33. He's already got six WAR on the year. He could conceivably have his best season ever this season by WAR at age 33. He's also still stealing bases. It seems like he's rejuvenated by being over there. And then what Mookie's doing is just freakish. So I wanted to kind of compare Mookie's season this year to what he did in 2018 when he won the MVP with us. Obviously, that year he went 30-30, 32 home runs with 30 stolen bases, hit .346, .438, .640 with a 185 WRC plus while playing elite defense in right field. He was one of the rare 10-plus WAR seasons. He finished at 10.5 WAR that year. This year, he's on pace to absolutely shatter what he did. He's already eclipsed the home run total. He's got 34. Based on different projection systems, they have him finishing anywhere from 40 to 45. I probably lean towards the 45 side there. He's got a pretty damn good shot to eclipse his high total of runs. He had 129 that year, 135 the year after. He's going to finish right around there this year as well. He's already got 86 RBIs. He's definitely going to be in line to eclipse his high RBI total as well. His high was 2016 with 113. In 2018, he only had 80, so he's already above that. Only 8 stolen bases this year, but he's still slashing 298, 394, 595 while playing all those positions. And, you know, he's got 6.4 WAR on the season right now. A big piece of that not being as high as his 2018 numbers is the defensive stuff, because he has moved around quite a bit. But, man, it's hard for me to look at this year and not think that it's every bit as special as the 2018 year that he had with us.
Yeah, I think you pretty much said everything there. I mean, the one thing that sticks out is that he hit 346 that other season, and that's a crazy number. You look at the... You're looking at the Fangraphs WAR. I'm looking at the Baseball Reference WAR, where he had 10.7, so pretty similar. And the only guy in the 2000s that has eclipsed that is Barry Bonds. Had an 11.7 and an 11.9. And then he had a 10.6 that was just below Betts. So yeah, it's just been Bonds since 2000. And we know that story. Aaron Judge right below him, 10th of a WAR below what Betts did that season. Yeah, I end up catching like the start of a lot of Dodgers games just after the Red Sox end at 10:10. I'll watch like the first at bat. Maybe I'll see 2 at bats from Betts, and I feel like he homers half the time in this when I'm watching in his first or second at bat. It's like he gets a leadoff home run to start the game and put them ahead 1-0. It what seems like 2 or 3 days a week. And you know that he's going to do that at Fenway at some point this weekend. So, no, it's totally a special season that he's having. So many kind of parallels between the two. And, yeah, some of those counting numbers are going to eclipse that.
Yeah, it's really absurd how good he is at baseball. Continues to just play at these levels. I didn't think we'd see another season like that 2018 season from him. I don't know which one I'd rather have, this one that he's putting up right now or that one. They're both amazing years, but man, I think he might be the most fun player in baseball. If you had to kind of think about it and put Betts up against guys like Ronald Acuna or Kyle Tucker, who we were talking about before, or even his teammate Freddie Freeman, you know, some of the other stars in the game right now, kind of where would you rank Mookie Betts at this point?
Yeah, Acuna is the first name that comes to mind in terms of, you know, I guess he's a little bit younger, but just having a total package, although Betts is probably a little bit better defender, though Acuna's got a fantastic arm. So that kind of is first for me, but he's right there. He's in the top three. I'd have to think about it a little more, but I can't think of anyone other than Acuna that I'd put ahead there.
He is special. It's going to be an absolute treat to see him coming into Fenway. How are the Red Sox going to handle all this? Because they're going to have Mookie Betts back at Fenway. They're going to have J.D. Martinez, Kike Hernandez, Ryan Brazier. A lot of guys who they might be doing some tribute videos for.
The stats of these players that you reference this season on the Dodgers is infuriating. Is the first thing that comes to mind. You've seen what Ryan Brazier's doing, right? Yep. What kind of ovation is he going to get? I don't know. I guess he'll get a decent golf clap for his contributions to the World Series, but there he is. He's split out his partial season. Yeah, he has a 1.11 ERA in 24 innings with the Dodgers. Ugh, what an asshole.
I think it's going to be easy to politely clap for J.D. Martinez and Kike and Brazier. But with Mookie Betts, there's just going to be this air of overwhelming what if. Like,
Yeah.
Man, when I did my big Red Sox series of greatest Red Sox of all time, I debated for a little bit whether or not Dewey should be the top right fielder in Red Sox history just because of longevity. And it ended up putting Betts there just because, obviously, Dewey never did anything like Betts did at his peak. They're not really comparable players at the high end of their careers. And I think that for Red Sox fans, you know, seeing how well Mookie has taken to life in LA and the levels that he's still playing at, putting up the year that he's doing this year, it's going to be really hard for some of us to look at him in Fenway, not in a Red Sox uniform.
Yeah, and it's going to kind of be a spot for some of the players, a couple of players that he was traded for to stack up, you know, how they'll play in that series between Verdugo and Wong. And yeah, I mean, we've gone over the Betts topic plenty, and I think that we wish it kind of unfolded differently. It's something that they had control over. But no, it's going to be, I would imagine that he will get an ovation, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You got to be crazy to think that he won't get a standing O, and he absolutely deserves it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the fact that Friday night's game is on Apple TV, just like the one last Friday was, is frustrating. That's a game that everyone should be able to watch without getting some other subscription for.
Yeah.
Especially the first one at Fenway. That's frustrating.
Yeah, that is frustrating. Absolutely. All right, we have one question today to wrap up the show from the surfing guy. He says, based on this season's all-or-nothing results so far, how many more times will we be able to sing Dirty Water this summer? Will it exceed your original predictions? And if I recall back, and you're better at this than I am, Bob, but I think I predicted 83 wins, something like that.
Okay.
What were you at?
Yeah, I have 83 on our preseason roundtable article on the Over the Monster sites. I don't remember exactly where you were at. I think we were all within a game or two. I think we all had them over 500.
Yeah, I was like between 83 and 86.
When the season ends, we need to revisit some of those preview podcasts. There's some good material to look back on in there.
Some real meat on the bone there.
So. There is. That'll be its own episode at the end.
So what do you think? I mean, they got 66 wins at this point right now. What do you think they end the year at?
So if they go 500, then they would be 85 and 77. And that's basically what I'm going to put. I'm going to put them 500 the rest of the year because I think they have, if not the toughest, one of the two or three toughest schedules left this season. They're about to play 10 games against Houston and the Dodgers. I believe they've got all of those AL East opponents again, right? They're not done with any of those teams that are in front of them.
No, they've got all those teams. They've got Tampa Bay, Kansas City, Orioles, Yankees, Rangers, Blue Jays, White Sox, Rays, Rangers. And then they end the year with the Orioles.
Yeah, so you got Texas as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't think... I think if you want to be realistic, that's a crazy schedule with all the AL East teams in front of them, the Dodgers, the Rangers, the Astros. So I can't go any higher than 500, so I'll put them there. I'll put them 85 and 77, which is two games ahead of what I anticipated, and that might, a lot of years, get you a playoff spot, but I don't think it's going to this year.
All right, I'll go 83 and 79.
Okay.
I just, that schedule is a gauntlet, man. I think it's going to be exactly what we predicted, 83 wins.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, like we said 2 weeks ago, put yourself in a position to be playing important games, and that's what they've done. Reason that we talked about this for half the episode, these are really fun teams that they're going to see for the next 10 games. You know, they see Houston again on the back end of this, back at Fenway. It's going to be great atmosphere at Fenway for these, but I just don't know how well they stack up against a lot of the teams that are in front of them. So I will say 19 more wins. I guess you won't hear Dirty Water at all of them, but if you play that in your Alexa after each win, you can tee it up.
Just as long as you're not playing Sweet Caroline. I'm good with not hearing that song as long as I live.
I have to fight off some sort of current to not get into that right now. You're not going to...
With an hour in the show, you don't want to get into a Sweet Caroline discussion?
Way too late for you to bring up Sweet Caroline right now.
All right. Well, we're going to get out of here. Thank you guys for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. A little bit more optimism brought to you this episode, so we hope you like that as well. Follow Bob, follow me, follow the Over the Monster account, and we'll be with you again next week.